When we left John Graves in the last episode of From a Limestone Ledge, he was dreaming of, well, perhaps fantasizing is the right word, building his own 20 or 30 foot tall stone tower, from the top of which he might gaze out vacantly at far horizons, as he put it. Graves continues now in Chapter 3 with his wish to leave his mark upon the land. Set back from a gravel road in our county that I drive along fairly often, there's a less ambitious but actual embodiment of a similar dream. On the summit of a high conical rock hill clad in cedar stands a wooden hut atop four tall creosoted poles. It was erected by the city man and his son who bought that rough property a few years ago, and I'm told it's the only building on the place. With a couple of bunks and a cook stove for the weekends they spend there, hauling provisions up on a rope. For them, I suppose it serves, in an opposite sort of way, a function similar to that of the crawl space beneath a friend of mine's house in the city, which he used to frequent in his drinking days. He said he liked it there because he could look out at people and they couldn't look back at him. The rural owner-builder, as the alternative lifestyle people like to call him, does have something of a time problem in terms of his usual need to make a living, whether through a job elsewhere that supports him and his family and his country habit, through freelance piecework like welding or writing or fence building or crafts, or through a willingness and ability to depend on the land itself for his needs, or, as often, through some combination of these. Stones do not get put on stones or board on boards, alas, in a few odd minutes of odd days. But time does flex better out here, and has a less nervous, tick-tock demanding role in daily life than more up-to-date locales have allowed it to assume. Even for job holders and hard-slogging freelancers, spare time is more likely to be truly spare, and not cluttered with social pulls and little league games and briefcases hauled home full of frantic papers to occupy the evening until the highballs mercifully make sleep feasible. The livestock tasks and casual forage farming and fence fixing and other things that make up most country work in a region like mine all need to be done, and done right, but when to do them within limits is pretty much up to the doer. Our handful of real full-time farmers, cash row croppers who have to toil night and day when conditions are ripe for tillage or planting or harvest, have longish slack periods between such peaks of labor. Few men anywhere, of course, ever find enough time in life for all they have in mind, even those who have most in mind, to sit on a porch and squirt tobacco juice at morning glory blossoms. But if a countryman wants to do something badly enough, he can usually find the time, and needless to say, we constructors do badly want to construct. As for what the things are that we want to construct and how we go about it, they vary as widely as our tastes and our needs and our reasons for getting involved in such activity in the first place. Many just want, at the least cost possible, a functional country house and the functional outbuildings and other things that go with it. They shore up and add on to whatever existing structures there are, and when starting something from scratch, tend to use shortcut contemporary methods or even shorter cut traditional ones based on the abiding country conviction that anything a 2x10 will do, a 2x4 will do just about as well. On the other hand, some of us builders are on the hell for stout school, addicted to thick stone walls if we're strong enough and have more time than most folks, and in carpentry using more and heavier members than are technically required and bracing them to withstand tornadoes. Not a few people choose a piece of country property primarily because of the handsome old buildings that already stand there, restoring them and adding on with love and thought and hard labor. And a sprinkling, usually young and willing to go at the thing full time for as long as it takes, elect such alternative shapes and methods as domes and yurts and free-form shell concrete, or build intensely personal, often lovely structures out of salvaged materials and native timber and stone, free for the taking. For a certain kind of amateur builder, much time goes into the dreaming and planning and draftsmanship. I have sheaves on sheaves of paper tucked away in notebooks and file folders depicting future projects in detail and representing God knows how many hours of bemused, exhilarating work with T-square and ruler and protractor and pencil. Some date far back, as is shown by the absurdly low cost estimates scribbled on them and reflecting the prices charged 12 or 15 years ago for building materials. They range in sort from built-in walnut bookshelves and house additions to that squat tower and, more recently, a long vaulted cellar in the hillside behind the house. To build them all in the years that are left to me, even if I wax fairly optimistic about those years' number, would require the existence of plentiful, happy, dirt-cheap helpers of the sort that the owner-builder of Monticello could count on, but not we modern decorators of the landscape. Therefore, most of them will very likely never progress from paper to concreteness, but for those that I do get around to, the procedure will be mapped out. Unless I change it when the time comes, as happens more often than not. Others of the sect disdain such stodgy forethought and let their creations grow more or less spontaneously. This seems to be particularly true of amateur stonemasons, at least in our part of the world. Rural Texans are by tradition inclined toward taciturnity, both in speech and in other forms of self-expression. But a surprising number of them, when turned loose with rocks and mortar, will thumb their noses at understatement and let her rip. Besides Elm Tree, I have dozens of other examples of personalized masonry in my mental catalog of things to watch for on journeys. Some are houses compounded of red and white and brown stones and bits of petrified wood and beer bottles and things. Others are well houses or gazebos or wishing wells or dry ornamental fountains or yard walls. One admirable specimen of which, near Yvonne, Texas, as I recall, although it could be Goldthwaite or San Saba, consists of some huge slabs of thick-ledged limestone set up on end and cemented into a footing trench with their abutting irregular edges fitting to perfection. The intended purpose of some masonry items is not to be discerned, either because they're follies put up for the pure joy of it, or because they stand unfinished, maybe forever, extensive stonework being such heavy, slow labor that many a novice practitioner either dies or quits somewhere along the way. One project whose growth I've been watching for 7 or 8 years has unplumb walls of rounded riverbed stones and is one room deep and quite long, maybe 70 feet by now. It has window and door openings in its highway side, and something of the look of an old-style mom-and-pop tourist court. But its ceilings, if they ever go in, will be less than 6 feet from the floor. Every time I see it, a bit more length has been added, and once I had the luck to catch its creator at work when I passed. He was a fierce and precipitate old fellow, to judge by the way he slapped his mortar into place and rammed his stones down into it. And he was, of course, quite short. Houses are the most relevant buildings for most people, but oddly, a good many amateur builders who will tackle a barn or other outbuilding with self-expressive gusto shy away from house construction to the point of inhabiting mobile homes or bringing in professionals to put up for them a suburban-style ranch house devoid of any imprint save that of an ominous conformity. To a degree, this has to do with the fact that, in our time, the houses that are acceptable to more prospective inhabitants, but especially to wives, have stopped being a space enclosed by walls and a roof and equipped with some means of cooking and staying warm, and have become machines for living, stuffed with complex devices that click and whir and groan, and veined with cables and pipes and ducts. But in large part, too, it is rooted in the circumstances, also unpalatable to wives, that owner-built homes can take a hell of a while to get finished. Members of an owner-builder's family, in fact, often get to live in partly unfinished quarters for considerable lengths of time, perhaps for the rest of their lives if they're willing to stick around that long. Sometimes this has to do with money and the owner-builder's frugal determination not to spend it till he has it. More often it has to do with time and the abandonment of, say, unpainted but installed and functional doors and windows and such items for more pressing parts of the job or for the crass pursuit of dollars, after which it's remarkable how quickly the OB's eyes can cease to focus on those items in complete state. Again, it may derive from some things needing to be done before others can be finished, which accounts for the fact that our present living room, the stone cabin which was my first residential project on the place and is now intended to serve ultimately as a library, has no baseboards some 16 years after its construction because there's no point in cutting and fitting baseboards until the built-in bookshelves are up. And finally, there is the grandiosity that sometimes sneaks in on country building schemes, unawares, and leads an obsessee into visions of 4,000-odd square feet of higgledy-piggledy living space where he once thought 2,000 would be plenty, as indeed it would. Hence, on wintry mornings, my ladies have to trudge to breakfast from their bedrooms to the old house across an expanse of windswept, half-frozen mud, where in time there will be, if I last and God is willing, a big living room and a new kitchen. What is certain about us cousins of the mad arch builder of M-Tree is that we are rarely bored and never hard up for something to occupy such odd bits of loose time as may confront us. What is less certain is that we spend our loose time wisely, but then obsession seldom has much truck with wisdom. At any rate, when we depart this vale, we'll leave a few assemblies of stone and planks about with our own marks upon them, and maybe here and there a tower upthrust against fate. And I, for one, find it in me to hope that if in distant years someone like me passes by and sees these things, he'll pause and examine and then perhaps raise a hand and salute, recognizing the kinship between us. Chapter 4 is entitled simply, Meat. At bottom, human existence is and ever has been quite gory, even if you leave out wars and feuds and duels and murders and other forms of intra-specific violence. The main shed blood has been that of man's fellow creatures, and its flow has been steady and copious. In a sense, we've floated on it from where we once were to wherever it is we are now. The byproducts of this slaughter, leather, fur, sinew, bone, horn, and all that, have been essential equipment on our voyage all the way down to the age of plastics. While the chief thing sought, meat, has been so central to our well-being that few of us can think of good food without it. For there is no more basic element in the old human experience than the killing of other species of animals for their flesh. Nor do most of us need to read Robert Ardrey to be convinced of that. The proof is in the eating. Most people like to set their teeth in animal protein, and if a good many of them in the world don't get to do so very often, that isn't so much through preference as because meat and fish and fowl, being in prime demand and a few notches up the food chain, are costly. And every piece that shows up on a dinner table sits there in lucid testimony that some creature died at somebody's hands for the diner's benefit and delectation. There are still parts of the world, most of them distant from most of us, where people depend on the oldest way on wild meat harvested in wild places. Elsewhere, the bloodshed is as heavy as it was among Comanches and Zulus and skin-clad Ice Age Europeans, but it involves mainly domesticated beasts dispatched out of sight and hearing of those who will consume them. Even our butchers seldom slaughter anything anymore, that function having been taken away by packing houses that ship out carcasses to be cut up for sale. Except in small towns, the backyard flocks of chickens that used to furnish part of a neighborhood's morning symphony, as well as part of its food, have vanished, as have goats and the hutches of Belgian hares that people here and there throughout the suburbs once raised to eat. One of my own early recollections of meat killing is of a man down our street who strung up the young male hares on a fence by their hind legs and gave the coo with a chop of his hand to their napes. Some squalled before he whacked them, most piteously to ears that had lately absorbed a reading of Peter Rabbit. There is a general feeling among Peter Rabbit readers, as well as others, I suppose, that the change represents attainment of a higher level of existence. Meat creatures with their manure and noises and ailments and the details of their demise and dismemberment have been banished, along with other troublesome basics, such as sewage and old folks and the laying out of corpses, to an invisible realm out there. And through the paper dollar's purchasing power, we move ever nearer, or seem to be moving until just lately, to that aseptic world shown in TV commercials where happiness dwells in aerosol bombs and pantyhose eggs, food comes pre-cooked on a tray, few people seem to age, except into gently beaming dentured grandparents with mild arthritis that's easily soothed by patent remedies, and toilets, as well as armpits, smell sweet. All this has influenced country life too, of course, but probably less in terms of food than of other things. The country raises food for sale, and eats some of what it raises, even if less than in former subsistence times. Here in Texas, most country places are at least partly dedicated to the nurture of meat animals, and meat-eating countrymen take advantage of that fact, often doing some or all of the work involved in getting creatures from pasture to pen or skillet. In the general absence of help, not many of us slaughter beeves anymore, for a 1,000-pound steer spraddled dead on the ground is a large, daunting hunk of something to have to deal with. Instead, when such a beast is fat enough to suit us, we trailer him to a small-town locker plant to be expertly, sometimes, killed and aged and cut up and frozen. Most swine go this route now, too, though the happy and ancient ritual of wintertime hog-killing by large families or cooperating neighbors, with its several squealing victims and its hoists and barrels of simmering scald water and scrapers and sharp knives and guts tubs and ash-roasted spleens and drafts of warming whiskey, is not yet entirely obsolete among true countrymen. Such hog-butchering is necessarily a group job, and individual members of a group that have been doing it together over the years tend to get reputations as especially good stickers or carcass splitters or whatnot. One friend of mine had an uncle who drank so much on these occasions that he wasn't allowed to do anything but hold a washtub to catch the entrails as the belly was slit and they popped out, and he wasn't much good even at that. "Now," he would insist, barging in among the flashing knives with his tub and making the pendant carcass swing. "Not yet," they'd say, and shove him aside, only to be assaulted again a moment later. "Now?" And as often as not, some of the innards would spill in the dirt when he did try to get to catch them. These matters are not for the squeamish, who are widespread enough nowadays that even such small livestock intended for home consumption, lambs and kids and veal calves and such, and more rarely poultry, is carted off to locker plants to meet its fate out of sight. Nearly all of us shirk the job thus on occasion, either because time presses us or for less valid reasons. A big pet weather goat that's turned mean, for instance, needs to be disposed of, and has some good meat on him, since he's been gobbling grain and other richness all his life. But he has a personal given name, too, and was bottle-fed at the house as a kid, and even if you can nerve yourself to butcher him on the place, some members of your family are going to be queasy about his meat on the table. Usually they are, that is. A fellow I know had a goat of that type which had grown so obnoxious that nobody in the family could go outside with a good stick in hand. He hired a man to come do the killing, not wanting to face it himself, and after the goat had been tethered beneath an oak limb for hoisting after slaughter, and the moment of truth was nigh, he shooed his children indoors to avoid traumatization. But when the knife went in, they were all peeking out of windows and broke into exuberant cheers. The butting they had received from old Thomas Whiskers had long since wiped out any affection, and the throat-cutting represented nothing to them but solid, overdue revenge. They ate him with pleasure, too. Sometimes, to get around a problem of sentimentality or revulsion, you can work out a swap with somebody else who has a spoiled pet on hand, these being numerous and mostly goats. Or you can grind yours into sausage after slaughter. Goat meat mixed with pork fat and seasoned right makes up as well as venison, maybe better, and the nature of sausage is such as to deflect most feelings but appetite, as witness the popularity of the common weenie among consumers, young and old, who think they wouldn't be caught dead eating the snouts, lips, navels, and other delicate components that go into this democratic worst. Pets accepted, there's a good bit of solid satisfaction in butchering an animal raised in your own place and turning him into good meat for yourself and your family and friends. The satisfaction has nothing to do with the love of killing. In my life, I've occasionally met twisted types who seem to get their kicks that way, either at hunting or with tame beasts, and after discerning this, I've stayed good and clear of them. You do the killing as quickly and cleanly as you can, because it's there to do, and you swing the carcass up into the air with a gambrel stick lodged between its hind legs, and then with honed, shapely knives you get on with the gutting and skinning and cutting up, and the satisfaction lies in the fact that you're engaged in a very ancient and honorable procedure of providing meat. Being able to do it, and knowing how, and facing all the implications that eating flesh entails. Oddly, or maybe not, even with something as small and simple to handle as a suckling cabrito, that's a baby goat, it's good to have company with you, and I speak as a usual loner. This isn't a matter of sharing guilt, but is ancient too, I suspect, tied in with old tribal ways of sharing out the spoils of a hunt. For hunting, although as a subject it constitutes a bottle of worms that I do not intend to uncork here, is the original activity on which all this meat-getting is patterned. And in its convivial aftermath, when quail are being plucked and gutted or deer are being dressed, there's much for me the same feeling I've known, for instance, in old-time, joyous, loud country hog-butcherings. Now and then I've been invited to places where, after a hunt, the game was turned over to hirelings for this work, and sometimes tired enough to be glad of it. I've nevertheless felt cheated out of a part of what the day had to offer, the pleasure of a job fully done. It is, I grant, not a pleasure that everybody seems to be built to enjoy, and I don't suppose there's anything wrong with that, but insofar as I worry about the morality of such things, I see even less wrong with the pleasure itself, at least if the person in question eats meat. Toward conscientious vegetarians I feel much respect, although I'm not shaped to share their taboos. But to my fellow carnivores, I would suggest there's a good strong dose of honesty and philosophical completeness and occasional full knowledge of just what meat-eating means. And I don't believe that dose is obtainable wrapped in plastic film in a supermarket bin. In Chapter 5, John Graves moves, perhaps mercifully, from hog slaughtering to the delights and disasters of homemade winemaking. He entitles Chapter 5, Vin de Paix. The old, old yearning toward physical self-sufficiency for families and clans runs strong in uncertain times. Nearly all of us sojourners in the countryside have a medium to large shot of it flowing in our veins, whether we have returned to the land or never left it in the first place. Society being complex and many-tentacled, self-sufficiency these days tends to be fragmentary at best, but that doesn't lessen an addict's satisfaction in short-circuiting the great machine, cheating the system, rolling his own, and coming up with something he needs and can use, generally at very small cost. No home will ever be more his than the one his hands have erected or restored to beauty and function. No meal will ever fill him more pleasantly full than that dinner in lavish June, when every piece of food on the table, save perhaps a little bit of olive oil and salt and such, comes off his own place. As for drink on that same table, someone has written also that no wine will ever taste bad that you've made yourself, a statement with a nice ring to it that crops up in books and articles on home winemaking. Unfortunately, it is hogwash. Unless the average beginning winemaker has extraordinary luck in the matter of his raw materials as well as his manipulation of them, and unless he has a very shallow awareness of just how good wine can be, he's going to turn out a certain amount of what even he can recognize as slop. He's going to turn out some potable wine, too, whether sooner or later, and when he does, he's going to give it the full benefit of any doubt because it's his own, as I do when I tell myself, and sometimes others to my shame, that a particular early batch of acid red, made by guess and by God from garden grapes of indifferent quality, is better than some wine I've had in Europe. Without adding that in far nooks of the Pyrenees and elsewhere, long ago in roaming days, I was served some really awful tooth-roughening stuff. But like doctors, we dabblers in enology have the privilege of burying our worst mistakes, as the live oaks around my house can bear witness, their roots having absorbed several libations of fluid judged unfit for human consumption after fermentation and aging. And eventually we grow warier, wiser, and a little better at our craft, or at least I assume from watching others that we do, my own experience having been limited and sporadic to date, and my growth having been reached only the wary half-wise stage. The idea, of course, is to produce something that people can not only drink, but like, and thus far I've turned out only a modest quantity that could be offered to visitors with a fair chance of such a result. Most of it has been mead, honey wine, the stuff that our distant Nordic forebears guzzle from bulls' horns and human skulls in warriors' halls in winter while banging on the table for more roast wild pig, and reading poetic recollections of murder and pillage and rape along the Irish coast. No guest of ours has ever been rendered violent from quaffing this mild beverage, made dry rather than sweet and without any heavy spicing. It's a good table drink, especially with light food. True, it isn't really wine, but then neither are many of the other concoctions that the fermentation mania leads us beginners into brewing out of peaches, blackberries, plums, potatoes, and other organic matter. Sugar plus enzymes yields alcohol plus carbon dioxide, goes the oft-cited equation, crudely put, and anything left over is flavor, which in skillful hands can be manipulated with sometimes surprising success. So, when what started out as the juice of parsnips or rhubarb stalks may end up tasting like rather nice dry sherry.